Talks within Russia and Ukraine resume after two sides hint progress in discussions to end the conflict. The U.S. warns China against helping Russia evade sanctions as Beijing accuses Washington of spreading disinformation about military aid to Moscow. Plus, Iran signed that the Vienna talks have been centered on U.S. obligations under the JCPOA, and Washington needs to make a political decision to revive the deal. I'm Behrouz Najafi. Now let's start with developments in Ukraine. On the 19th day of the Russian offensive in that country, all eyes are on the latest round of peace talks between the two sides. Kiev says it's seeking to discuss a ceasefire, an immediate withdrawal of troops, and security guarantees. Ukrainian authorities have also renewed calls for further Western pressure on Moscow to avoid a larger war. Ukraine has accused Russia of carrying out a shelling against the residential building in the capital, Kiev, killing at least one person. The Kremlin denies targeting civilian areas. It says any progress in regulating the situation is dependent on Ukraine's willingness to compromise. According to initial reports, the latest round of negotiations between the two sides is currently underway via video conference. The previous talks had ended with rare progress. Robert Carter is in the Polish city of Lublin near the Ukraine border. We've talked to him regarding the latest on the exodus of Ukrainians from their country.
The situation has grown so critical, actually, that Polish local authorities are beginning to issue warnings both to the Polish government but also to other European governments that Poland will soon be in a position where they simply can't cater for any more people. The numbers are continuing to rise. Thousands of Ukrainians continue to cross the border every single day. And obviously the majority of the efforts, the relief efforts that's taking place inside Poland is a volunteer relief effort. So it's just ordinary Poles who are coming out, donating food, clothes, water, everything, nappies for babies, for example, as well. Everything you can think of is mostly being donated by civilians and also the volunteers that come out to help greet Ukrainian refugees in. Most of them are volunteers too. So the situation is critical. And obviously with the fighting that's going on in Ukraine, with the news of these recent strikes that were conducted near the Ukrainian border city of Lviv, that of course has raised considerable concern about the position that Poland is in as well in regards to what's going on militarily inside Ukraine as well. Could Poland be dragged into the situation that's going on in Ukraine? That is a big question on everyone's mind.
News review time to stay tuned. The United States warning China of consequences if it helps Moscow evade sanctions over its military action in Ukraine.
We are communicating directly, privately to Beijing that there will absolutely be consequences for large-scale sanctions evasion efforts or support to Russia to backfill them. We will not allow that to go forward and allow there to be a life to Russia from these sanctions from any country.
Now Sullivan says Washington is watching closely to see to what extent Beijing provides economic or material support to Russia. He made a comment prior to his meeting with senior Chinese diplomat Yang Qingrong. China has denied reports that Moscow asked it for military aid in its fight against Ukraine. It's called such assertions from U.S. officials, quote, disinformation from Washington. Beijing says it's acting as a neutral mediator between the two sides. The U.S. and its Western allies have imposed crippling and unprecedented sanctions against Russia while providing billions of dollars to Ukraine. Let me invite you two guests and get some insight. Barry Grossman, international lawyer and political analyst, is joining me from Bali, Indonesia. Also, John Stepling, author and commentator, is joining us from Indre, Norway. Good to see you, gentlemen. Let's go to Bala first. Barry, China saying I'm acting as a neutral mediator, and the West, you hear what they're calling, you know, they're threatening China. So what do you think is happening? Why should China offer any help to Russia?
Well, the question is whether Russia actually asked for help and whether, in fact, China is offering it. They certainly have tightened up their relationship in recent months and become very close allies. It's also quite clear that China has publicly stated that as far as this crisis in the Ukraine goes, it considers that it's the U.S. that's responsible for creating over the past several years the situation which inevitably has led to where we're at now. But it's interesting when we look at some of these reports that have been bandied around in the last few days, we have another scenario of second-tier American media outlets and their counterparts in Europe citing not official pronouncements or press conferences held by individuals of political ranking, but other media reports published by the Washington Post, the New York Times, and CNN, claiming, first of all, that Russia has asked China for military support, military hardware, and secondly, for financial support in the face of these sanctions, which seems to involve a whole lot of spin and very little fact. What is clear is that Russia has complained that the U.S. is putting pressure on China to prevent Russia from drawing down its yuan reserves in China. And of course, the position we've seen taken over and over again in the Atlantic world in recent years is that when Washington wants it done, it leans on countries to effectively steal the foreign reserves of other nations, as we saw in the case of Afghanistan recently, and certainly before that with Venezuela and other countries. Once again, this is a bit of a storm in a teacup, and the idea that we've got these third tier, these third rung political bureaucrats essentially calling out and threatening superpowers like China in terms which sound like war shows just how ridiculous the situation is, and how instead of trying to defuse the situation, what we see coming from Washington is them doubling down to spread this this undeclared war against any nation which doesn't wholeheartedly submit to the United States and do whatever they're told to do, based on the U.S.'s assumption that it's somehow the leader of the known universe and in a position that's so special that it can dictate to other nations what their foreign policy should be. Certainly, if anybody tried to tell the United States that it should not do anything to help one of its allies and would face serious consequences if it did, it would lead to an uproar, an immediate uproar, and would be unheard of. Even supported nations like Israel that are constantly in violation of international law. So it beggars belief that we have this third rung also ran threatening China and, for that matter, Russia.
Yeah, very good point that Barry made, John, that the U.S. is free to do whatever it wants to help whoever it wants, no matter for whatever reason. So what's wrong? China is a sovereign country, even if it offers to help, which Russia says that's not the case. What's wrong with offering help? The U.S. is pouring billions of dollars to Ukraine. The different European countries are doing the same thing.
Well, as I said, I think last time I was on here with you, propaganda campaign from the United States around this crisis, so-called crisis, has been just mind-boggling, astounding. I've never seen this level of Russophobia and spin and bias in reporting, never ever in my life. You would think that that Putin, I mean, it's being described as Putin's war of choice. You would think that 7 years of shelling and terrorizing Donbass simply had never existed, that Putin hadn't gone to the UN in 2015 asking for help brokering a peace settlement. You would think that the U.S. orchestrating a bloody coup in 2014 that put a very hyper-nationalist neo-Nazi party in power in Ukraine, that never happened, that somehow Zelensky oversees a paragon of tolerant democracy. And of course, it's not the case. The government in Kiev has threatened Russia. They've said if they got nuclear weapons, if they got into NATO somehow, which is never probably going to happen, but they have said they would turn the nukes on Moscow. That was their goal. Now, the U.S. is in you know, no confusion about who these people are, but it's a very cynical ploy. They want regime change in Moscow. That was Victoria Nuland and all the neocons that advised Obama and now advise Biden. That was their plan all along. So China is, you know, is well aware of all of this. They are also well aware of what U.S. did in Hong Kong, U.S. policies towards Taiwan, the U.S. military buildup in the South China Sea. They know all this. They're under no illusion about what color revolutions really are. This is, you know, U.S. funded coups, essentially. It's not spreading democracy or anything. So Russia is being demonized. Putin is literally being called the new Hitler in the Western media.
Right.
And it's breathtaking because it is such one-sided, context-free propaganda coming out of the West now. And your other guest made a very good point, Mr. Grossman, made a very good point about the tone of U.S. representatives, of Anthony Blinken and Jake Sullivan. They're very, very bellicose and condescending and rude. They hector officials in China, and they, as they did before with Russia, and they go to the EU and they bully people there, although the EU is amenable to being bullied, but their tone towards China is insulting, and it's a kind of the American exceptionalism and its tone deafness is being seen here. So yeah, but I agree, this is a minor news story. I doubt Russia actually did ask them for anything, but China's going to decide with Russia. They understand what's really happening.
All right, now let's get back to our guests. Barry, so we've been hearing some positive signals from both sides, negotiating sides between Kiev and Moscow, and also China is saying that I'm ready to act as a mediator. So can we be optimistic that we're moving toward the end of this conflict?
Well, I hesitate to call it a full-blown military conflict at this point. What we have is a special operation that Russia felt compelled to undertake, knowing that if it didn't act, its enemies would act against it. I think we will reach a point where there's a bit of a stalemate, with Russia having the upper hand as it secures its borders and the Donbass region. But I don't think we're going to see anything settled in the short term. The U.S. seems quite committed to pushing forward with the neocon playbook that started back in the year 2000 with George W. Bush. And I would encourage people, really, if they want to understand what's going on in the U.S., to go back and take a look at what was cranked out by the Project for the New American Century, we call PNAC, and their overwhelmingly dominant article called Rebuilding America's Defenses, which called on the United States to completely restructure its military in order to fight simultaneous wars on multiple fronts, militarize space, militarize the internet, militarize everything using asymmetric warfare, in order to understand this. And I would add to that, it's necessary to understand that the United States seems hell-bent on basically imploding the global economy anyway, because it really needs to get its own populace in line with lower wages and lower benefits if it's going to move forward and be competitive in the world, and if it's going to be the boss or on climate change and carbon that's coming up. So they seem quite committed. They don't really care about the economic consequences. Okay. And it's all very troubling. But I don't see that there's going to be a final solution in the short term, even though one would think it would be relatively easy to reach one. China will do its best. It's made its position very clear. But I suspect it's going to be a long time before we see a final result. Mm-hmm.
Iran says the resolution of Vienna talks on the revival of the 2015 deal hinges on a political decision that the United States must make.
The remaining issues between us and the U.S. require a political decision in Washington, which is yet to be announced to us. When this happens, we will return to Vienna, The interests of the Iranian nation determine our path in the talks. Reducing what happens in Vienna to a single element, which is Russia's request, is what the U.S. wants, so that everyone forgets its own responsibility concerning the current situation. The U.S. is responsible for the current failure to get an agreement.
Foreign Ministry spokesman Said Khatibzadeh says the negotiations have been centered on U.S. obligations under the accord. He says Washington should now decide whether to accept its obligations or continue the policy of the Trump administration. Meantime, Secretary of Iran's Supreme National Security Council says that Iran will continue the Vienna talks until it gets its legitimate demands. Ali Shamkhani says that Iran is after what are called a strong deal. The JCPOA coordinator announced a pause in the Vienna talks on Friday due to what was described as external factors. Tehran has repeatedly called for the removal of U.S. sanctions verifiably and guarantees that those bans will not be reimposed. Saudi Arabia has executed 81 people over alleged terrorism-related charges in a day. The Saturday executions have drawn widespread condemnation. Iran called them an inhumane act that violated basic human rights and international law. It also slammed the Western countries for their double standard in instrumental use of human rights against independent nations. Lebanon's Hezbollah slammed the killings as a heinous crime. It said that Riyadh practices the ugliest form of sectarian discrimination. The Yemeni Committee for Prisoners of War warned of serious consequences for the al-Saud regime. According to reports, some 40 of those executed were from the Shiite-majority Qatif region. That's Saudi Arabia's highest number of recorded executions in a single day. Among them were also members of Yemen's Ansarullah movement. And that's it for this broadcast from Tehran. Thank you.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
Hame ba wujood qudde saratani Israel mukhalifim.
All of us are opposed to the cancer's tumor, Israel.
Wajh mushtarak hame wahdat ummat islami.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
This is the part of a speech delivered on February 17th, 2022 by Ayatollah Khamenei. The leader of the Islamic Revolution via video conference with the participation of people from Tabriz and East Azerbaijan, commemorating the anniversary of the Tabriz uprising of February 18, 1978.
Well, I wish to raise an important point here, and that is the fact that in the 4 decades after the victory of the revolution, many fruitful activities have been done for the sake of the continuation of the revolution. Some of these activities have been done voluntarily by the people, and some have been done by the government. Great achievements have been made in the past decades, but some people want to deny them. A few days ago, I said that we should not allow the current problems in the country to overshadow all these important and big feats accomplished over the years. These achievements should not be ignored. We had a lot of progress and a lot of achievements. An example is scientific progress. In the past revolutionary years, we were ahead of the rest of the world in terms of scientific progress. This is not my opinion, rather it is the opinion of the international centers. That is, the rate of our scientific progress is several times faster than the global average. Some have said it is 10 times faster, and some have said 13 times.
دنیای اسلام یک نسخه امروز دارد و اون اتحاد.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
Well, knowledge is very important. Knowledge is power. Knowledge is power in the real sense of the word. The well-known poem, "He who is knowledgeable is powerful," is correct. Knowledge brings about power and authority for every country. We have made scientific achievements in various arenas, achievements which were unimaginable in the beginning of the revolution. We ourselves were present in the front lines of the revolutionary activities, but we would not have believed that we would be able to make such progress in nuclear energy, nanotechnology, biotechnology, and in various complicated medical issues and very difficult surgeries, in the area of solving sterility, in the area of stem cells, and many other important scientific fields. But we have thankfully made progress in them. Our youth showed determination, moved forward, and made progress. Another achievement is in the area of basic infrastructure. One achievement was scientific progress, and another is infrastructural progress.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done for me through all.
Everyone, and welcome back to another episode of The Subcontinent.
The Subcontinent.
We'll be right back. Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of The Subcontinent. On this program, we will address the most important issues in the South Asian region that affect the governments, organizations, and most importantly, the people in the region. And as always, we will dissect the issues and present you with different perspectives from experts and people. So, stay tuned.
In this edition of The Subcontinent, we will discuss how minority Shias in Pakistan continue to live on the edge amid an alarming rise in targeted terrorist attacks. And we shall also take a look at deteriorating relations between Pakistan and the Taliban in the wake of fierce border clashes and violence.
A powerful explosion ripped through a Shia mosque in Pakistan's northwestern city of Peshawar during Friday prayers, killing at least 63 people and injuring 200 others. Described as the deadliest terrorist attack in several years, it targeted a historic mosque in a largely Shia neighborhood of Peshawar, sending shockwaves across the country. Responsibility for the ghastly attack was claimed by the Daesh terrorist group, which has stepped up its activities in the South Asian country in recent years with tacit support from the Pakistani Taliban.
On March the 4th, as worshippers assembled at Kocha Risaldar Mosque in centuries-old Kesahwani Bazaar of Peshawar for Friday prayers, a massive explosion tore through the mosque, leaving a trail of death and destruction. At least 63 people were killed and over 200 injured. Among the victims was prominent Shia cleric Allama Irshad Hussain Khalil. The youngest victim was a 6-year-old boy, Hussain Abbas, from Parachinar. It was the deadliest attack in Pakistan since July 2018, when a Daesh bombing killed 149 people in the city of Quetta. In Peshawar, a city of 2 million people near the border with Afghanistan, an attack of this scale had not been seen since 2014, when Tehrik Taliban Pakistan gunmen attacked an army school, killing 140 people, mostly students. As per eyewitness accounts, a motorcycle-borne assailant mowed down two policemen guarding the mosque before barging inside and detonating his suicide vest. There was dust and smoke everywhere as people ran frantically for their lives. Almost every household in the Shia neighborhood is mourning the loss of their loved ones. Police officials said there was no prior intelligence on the attack, but Prime Minister Imran Khan later admitted that intelligence agencies had all the information regarding the origin of terrorists. On Saturday, police investigators said the suicide bomber and his network had been identified.
Muslim-majority Pakistan has a bloodied history of sectarian violence and persecution of Shias. Violence perpetrated against the minority community by Takfiri terrorist groups has continued unabated for years, forcing many Shias to flee and take refuge in other countries. Those who chose to stay back continue to live on a razor's edge. Almost every city in the country today has a martyr's graveyard for Shias, bearing painful testimony to their unending ordeal. The graves keep piling up, and this time in Peshawar.
Pakistani Shias are among the most vulnerable and the bravest, prone to terrorist attacks. In recent years, groups such as Daesh, Tehrik-e-Taliban Pakistan, Lashkar-e-Jangvi and Sepah-e-Sahaba have carried out a spate of targeted attacks on them, mostly in cities bordering Afghanistan. The latest attack in Peshawar, the capital and the largest city of Khyber Pashtunkhwa province, was claimed by the Daesh terrorist group, which launched its Pakistan chapter in May 2019. The group considers Shias heretics and has claimed many dastardly attacks in the country. Peshawar bombing, however, was the deadliest yet. The carnage in the northwestern Pakistani city has drawn widespread condemnation in and outside the country. Pakistan's President Arif Alvi and Prime Minister Imran Khan, in separate statements, expressed their condolences and vowed action against the perpetrators. Interior Minister Sheikh Rashid Ahmed termed the attack as an attempt to disrupt peace in the country. Imran Khan's government faces intense scrutiny over unchecked violence targeting minority Shias. Shia organizations across Pakistan, including Tehrik Nafaz Fikh Jafariya, have held peaceful demonstrations over the tragic incident, demanding action against the perpetrators. Protests have spread to other countries as well, with calls in solidarity with Pakistani Shias growing louder.
Now, to have more insight, we are joined by Mr. Shehram Malik, researcher in cybersecurity and contemporary history. First of all, welcome to the program, Mr. Malik. As we've seen, violence targeting the minority Shia community continues unabated in Pakistan. So why have successive governments in Islamabad failed to crack down on these terrorist groups?
First thing I'd like to challenge you on is that the Shia community in Pakistan is not a minority. They are part of the very fabric of our society. Our founding father was Shia, Muhammad Ali Jinnah. He was belonged to the Ismaili Shia community. Some of our leaders, Zulfiqar Ali Bhutto, Shia, Asif Ali Zardari, who was president of Pakistan recently, he was Shia. Benazir Bhutto was Shia. So this concept that Shias are somehow a minority in Pakistan, we as Pakistanis do not recognize them as minorities. They are one of us. That's the first thing. This goes back to the time post-Iranian revolution when the jihad in Afghanistan started. Certain countries in the Middle East started funding mosques and madrasas within Pakistan and trying to stroke up this hatred not only towards the Americans but also towards the Shia community within the country. I mean, I'll give you my own example. I grew up, I am a Sunni, but I grew up about 10 meters from Imam Bargah. Nobody, none of my parents ever taught me to hate anybody. So this very idea is nonsense. The second thing is the state of Pakistan has been trying. The militant groups in southern Punjab, which were funded by the Middle East, like the big example is Lashkar-e-Jhangvi. They would target Shia Imam Bargahs, Shia mosques. That terrorist organization was completely wiped out by the Pakistani forces, by the Pakistani security apparatus in 2014. Then they found killers in the southern city of Karachi, where they were murdering Shia ulama and also Sunni ulama, and then their network was then basically propagating news within the media that one was done by the other. But the murders were actually performed by the same people, the same groups, and those groups were in fact trained in India. They had links to a guy who lives in England, by the way, not far from where I live, Altaf Hussain. So the state was complicit in the early 80s in allowing this hatred to actually fester and allow these groups to rise up. However, now the state is trying its best to wrap this up and fight these people. But unfortunately, now the foreign players have got involved. They're getting funding. They've got a safe haven in Afghanistan, in areas which the Taliban do not control at the moment. And that is where the struggle is. Now, the state is trying by stabilizing the Taliban government, because that's the only way they'll be able to progress. If there is stable Afghanistan, there will be stable Pakistan.
Now, Mr. Malik, the Peshawar mosque bombing was claimed by the Daesh terrorist group. Now, do you think the Daesh and a Tehreek Taliban Pakistan and other groups are working in tandem?
Just before I answer that question, I am originally from Peshawar. About 2 months ago, I walked past that mosque. That mosque is in the old city of Peshawar, which is a very crowded area. There are a lot of shops in the area. It's an ancient part of the city. So these demons, it's basically an insult to human beings to call these people actually human. The Taliban and Daesh, the TTP, now I'm not talking about the Afghan Taliban here, TTP, the Tehreek-e-Taliban Pakistan, are directly linked to Daesh. A lot of their leaders, I mean, I can go through the names, but we do not have time at the moment, they have actually sworn allegiance to the leader of Tehreek-e-Taliban, Daesh, Khurasa. So they're working in tandem. All the splinter groups that have been defeated by the Pakistan military operation in the tribal, previously known as tribal areas, were pushed out. And now they're in Afghanistan. About 6 months ago, they actually got together and swore allegiance to one another, saying that now they will target Pakistan together. So it's a complicated situation. And then to top it all off, you've got foreign funding. I mean, keeping these groups going and providing them with arms, it's not something that just happened. They are getting funding. And I think at this point, I would also like to say that Pakistan also needs support from its neighbors, especially Iran, to hold those countries that fund these organizations to account. Because breaking up the very fabric of the Pakistani society can only happen by creating these chasms within the two major groups that live in Pakistan. 15% of the Pakistani population is Shia. So the most obvious chasm is this. And this is not something that's unknown within the modern fight by Muslims to keep them, their nations together. We've seen it in Iraq, we've seen it in Syria, we've seen it in Lebanon. So it's a complicated situation that can only be dealt with if we deal with it as a community together.
There you have it, Mr. Shehram Malik, researcher in cybersecurity and contemporary history. Thank you for being on the program, sir. Now, let's see what people on social media had to say.
Tahir al-Qadri, a top Pakistani Sunni cleric, condemns the Peshawar mosque suicide bombing, saying those who spill the blood of innocents in the house of God cannot be Muslims. Founder and leader of Pakistan's MQM political party, Altaf Hussain, denounces the attack in Peshawar as naked terrorism, which he says raises question marks on the performance of security agencies. Rauf Kiasra, an author and columnist from Islamabad, calls the Peshawar tragedy painful, asserting that people at the helm must be held accountable for this massacre and their inefficiency.
You're listening to The Subcontinent, broadcast by IRIB English Radio. This weekly program reviews ongoing developments in India, Pakistan, and Bangladesh. Listen to The Subcontinent every Monday here on IRIB English Radio.
Since the Taliban in a dramatic fashion swept back to power in Afghanistan last August, tensions between the group and Islamabad have grown. Pakistani authorities allege that the Taliban are allowing the Afghan territory to be used by militant groups to attack Pakistan. The group denies the charges, but is infuriated over the construction of a fence by Pakistan along the 2,700-kilometer border with Afghanistan, which has long been a bone of contention between the two sides.
On February the 24th, at least two people were killed and dozens injured in fierce border clashes between Afghanistan's Taliban and Pakistani troops. The firefight resulted from a dispute over the construction of a military checkpoint in a southwestern border area that divides Pakistan's Chaman and Afghanistan's Spin Boldak. Both sides traded accusations over the violence. Taliban spokesperson Zabiullah Mujahid claimed that Pakistani forces were the first to open fire, calling it regrettable. A Pakistani security official was quoted as saying that Taliban fighters made the first move and opened unprovoked fire at them. Thousands of people daily cross the border, mostly from Afghanistan.
The Chaman Spinboldek incident came weeks after intense clashes were reported at a northwestern border post in Khurram district. 5 Pakistani soldiers were killed in the incident, claimed by Tehreek Taliban Pakistan militants allegedly operating from the Afghan territory. It prompted Pakistan's Foreign Minister Shah Mahmood Qureshi to send a strongly worded message to the Taliban. He said if the group cannot address the concerns of Pakistan, no one will trust them and their promise of cutting ties to Al-Qaeda and other such groups. The statement raised eyebrows in Kabul, where the interim Taliban government has been vigorously campaigning for international legitimacy amid the worsening economic and humanitarian crisis.
The time-tested relations between Pakistan and the Afghan Taliban have developed strains in recent months owing to border skirmishes and disputes over the construction of fencing on the Durand Line, which divides the two neighboring countries. Pakistan has been erecting the fencing to prevent the infiltration of militants from Afghanistan. Taliban, however, doesn't recognize the border, a line adopted by successive governments in Kabul over the years. And now, the protracted border dispute threatens to turn allies into arch foes.
After their government was overthrown by the US-led military coalition in 2001, the top Taliban leadership took refuge in neighboring Pakistan. From their bases in Pakistan, they launched the full-scale armed movement to free Afghanistan from US occupation. The struggle ultimately bore fruit after 20 years, which many saw as a strategic triumph for Islamabad. 7 months on, cracks have already appeared in their relationship, mainly due to the long-standing dispute over the Durand Line. The de facto border created by British colonialists is considered by Afghans a historic mistake. Taliban have adopted the same line, refusing to accept it. Pakistan started fencing the porous border in 2014 to prevent cross-border attacks and smuggling. In recent months, there have been reports of the Taliban attempting to break the fencing in many areas. Taliban's Defense Ministry spokesperson in a statement in January said Pakistan had no right to fence the border and divide ethnic Pashtuns. Amid growing tensions between the two sides over the border fencing, there has also been an alarming uptick in violence with dozens of military personnel killed in attacks on Pakistani army outposts along the border with Afghanistan. Most of these attacks have been claimed by the Pakistani Taliban, who feel emboldened by the Afghan Taliban's dramatic takeover in Kabul.
Now, to have more insight, we are joined by political analyst Mr. Akib Mahmood. Welcome to the program, sir. Now, relations between the Taliban and Pakistan appear to have developed strains in recent months following some fierce border clashes. So, has the relationship reached a breaking point?
I don't think it's reached a breaking point because at the moment, the only government that is really engaging with them is the Pakistani government. So the Taliban are shrewd political operators, and they understand that they need to be accepted by the international community. And so I don't think they will put their relationship with the Pakistan government in any kind of jeopardy, especially when they consider that it was Pakistan who brought them to the negotiating table and negotiated the U.S. exit. It was Pakistan who helped them the most throughout the last 20 years and in terms of the U.S. exit from Afghanistan. So I don't think it's at breaking point. Yes, certainly relationships are strained, but they're not overly difficult at the moment. So there will be a diplomatic solution to this somehow.
Mr. Mahmood, Pakistani authorities allege that TTP militants are using the Afghan soil to launch attacks on Pakistan, but Afghan Taliban denies it. So what is the truth in your opinion?
The truth is that the TTP themselves were in a ceasefire with the Pakistan government after the Taliban took over. The Taliban acknowledged at the time that no one will be allowed to use Afghan soil against Pakistan, and they're committed to that. And that's where the ceasefire, that's what the ceasefire was born out of. They wanted Pakistan and the TTP to negotiate a deal of some sort and come to an understanding, because the TTP realized that the Taliban are now the major stakeholder in Afghanistan, and they wanted to be absorbed into the Taliban, the Afghan Taliban, and the Afghan Taliban wanted to ensure that the TTP was on the same page as them vis-a-vis Pakistan, and not using Afghan territory against Pakistan. So that ceasefire ended in December of last year. And since then, we've seen a steady sort of rise in intelligence-based operations against TTP militants and other militant groups that are based in Afghanistan, in Pakistani territory and places like that. So in the border areas, in the former tribal areas. So the truth is somewhere in between, that the Taliban, the TTP, are in Afghanistan, and they are using it against Pakistan.
Now, Mr. Mahmood, let's talk about the construction of a fence by Pakistan on the Durand line, which has also fueled tensions between the two sides. How do you look at this protracted dispute over the de facto border?
The dispute over the border, which is essentially an internationally recognized border and has been consistently for the last 100 or so years, the dispute arises from the fact that the Taliban, the base of the Taliban, is basically the Pashtun tribes of that border region, southern Afghanistan, eastern Afghanistan, and which is basically western and southwestern Pakistan. And those people, those Pashtun tribes, are split by that Durand line. So while the Taliban would accept that it's a border, they would not accept it as a hard border. They would not accept it as the way that Pakistan is now fencing that border and creating a barbed wire border with extra security features to ensure non-encroachment. So Pakistan is looking after its own security, especially after the last 20 years where Afghan territory has been used against Pakistan. Before, when the Taliban was in power in the 90s, that border was an open border. Anyone could come and go. It was very porous, and Pakistan had no security threat from there. But Pakistan cannot allow it to be used again, as it was in the last 20 years since the American invasion. And so Pakistan is fencing that. This has been discussed quite extensively with the Taliban, and there hopefully will be a diplomatic solution, as the Islamic Emirates have suggested that they will discuss this diplomatically and resolve the issue diplomatically. As far as the incidents of clashes on the border and stuff like that, you've got to understand that the Taliban is not a centralized organization at the moment. It has a lot of disparate organizations which have joined it, and some of them are more nationalist than others, and will be looking at the border fence as something which needs to be resisted by violence. So, some of those groups will need to be reined in by the Afghan Taliban leadership.
On that note, I would like to thank Mr. Aqib Mahmood for his precious time and knowledge. Now, let's see how people have reacted on social media.
Pakistan-based journalist Salim Shahid reports about the suspension of trade and other business activities between Pakistan and Afghanistan after border clashes between the two sides. Michael Kugelman, the senior associate at the Wilson Center, notes a drop in terrorist incidents after the U.S. withdrawal from Afghanistan, but points to a surge in cross-border attacks from Afghanistan. A Pakistan-based journalist, Iftikhar Firdaus, cites the Pakistani military's media wing as saying that they strongly condemn the use of Afghan soil for militancy directed at Pakistan.
And that was our episode about the relentless persecution of minority Shias in Pakistan and the growing tensions between Pakistan and the Taliban over border skirmishes and violence. We shall meet again next week. So till then, take care.
Is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily, round the clock, for listeners across the globe. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via the internet, shortwave radio, FM, and satellites. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 41 meters, 7,300 kilohertz, every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to the English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 49 meters, 6040 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave, 25 meters, 11,880 kilohertz, every day from 1920 to 2020. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our programs via FM 91.5 megahertz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and Iransat or BAD 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is pastoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, P.O. Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran. Or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about our audio quality and other means. Thank you.
Questions and answers on Islamic beliefs.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of Allah, the most compassionate, the most merciful. May Allah's peace and blessings be upon the Holy Prophet of Islam, Muhammad, and his immaculate progeny. Dear brothers and sisters all around the world, assalamu alaikum and welcome to yet another edition from a series of Q&A in Islamic beliefs from IRIB English Radio. Dear brothers and sisters, if you have been following this series of shows, we are trying to answer the doubts and misconceptions on the Islamic beliefs which are received usually in the form of questions from different questioners from around the world. The question of the day that has been asked is, again, concerning the personality and characteristics of an imam as a role model and the leader of the Islamic Ummah. It has been asked that how should we call an imam, or how should we look at an imam as a role model while he lived, let's say, 14th century ago or 13th century ago? And how can he be a role model for us today? This question actually stems from the different doubts and misconceptions that says that, for example, the lifestyles have changed and facilities that people had at that time were limited, and let's say the knowledge of people at that time was quite limited. And even the time of the Prophet, for example, the society was not that mature. And now with the modern technologies, we have everything, so no need to look at them as a role model. And what does it mean that to stay living, for example, in 14th century ago, based on the circumstances that the Prophet of Islam or even the Imams have been living? Does it look rational and, let's say, rational and wise to follow whatever they have been saying for the people of that time? So definitely the needs and requirements of people also changed. This is the question that we want to ask it from the respected guest, the speaker of the show, Sheikh Nur Muhammad, and ask him to shed some light on that. Sheikhna, the question was quite clear, and the concern of the brother or sister who has asked this question is quite clear. So, are we really in need of such role models from past, and can't we find the same role models in our today's era, and we are obliged to follow the same role models that is starting from the Holy Prophet of Islam and actually continuing in the lineage of the Prophet through the Imams of Ahlul Bayt?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. You see, they're talking about the Islamic lifestyle, or, for example, Noble Prophet or Ahlul Bayt. They're considered to be role models for our youth and for, of course, all peoples, you see that when we look at the, for example, talking about Islamic lifestyle, you see that this lifestyle is completely, we can practice it nowadays. Mm-hmm. I want to say that if you go to the, for example, you see that we have a lot of shows and episodes about the Islamic lifestyles.
True.
Islamic lifestyle. And of course, we have a lot of definition and explanation in the verse of Noble Quran and in the narrations of Ahlul Bayt expanding on Islamic lifestyle. You see that we can have this Islamic lifestyle, and I believe that it is a best version of lifestyle nowadays, even in this modern era that we are living in this contemporary era. Mm-hmm. We can have this lifestyle and we can choose it and we can practice it. And True. It is one of the best, of course.
Yeah.
You see that about the, for example, Noble Prophet Muhammad or his pure progeny, they are our role models. Mm-hmm. They are our role models because we have in the verses of Noble Quran or in the narration talking about this personality to be perfected human being, and Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala introduced them to be our role models.
Yeah.
I want to say that we have history gap between us and between them. Mm-hmm. Of course, it is no doubt about that. But how they are considered to be our role models. For example, if you go to the Sunan al-Nabi and the tradition of the Noble Prophet, and of course about his lifestyle, or for example, about the lifestyle of Ahlul Bayt, alayhimu salatu wassalam, we can practice this their lifestyle, and of course we can have them to be our role models.
Yeah.
You see that, for example, Noble Prophet was against oppression. Mm-hmm. And he was, if you go to the tradition of Noble Prophet and about his Sunnah, we have some books which has been compiled about the Sunan al-Nabi or about the tradition of Noble Prophet and his customs. You see that he was, for example, giving some charity to the orphans.
Yeah.
And his practice, he was always against the oppression and injustice. Of course, I want to say that we have a lot of codes in this year, in this era, talking about Islamic lifestyle and the lifestyle of Noble Prophet. We can practice the same. Even in this time, we can be, of course, we have to be against injustice. Mm-hmm. We should give charity to the poor people and to the destitute, and so on and so forth.
So what you mean is that we just need to take the basics and basis from them. So if we have got to know and got familiar and acquainted with the basis of their thinking system, so that would be enough for us. When we are looking after the Prophet, when we are following the Holy Prophet, it means that we are following the culture that he brought up to the humanity, or the Imams of Ahlul Bayt, because then we have become familiar with the basis of their thinking system.
Exactly. I want to say that we have some differences, or forms are maybe different. Mm-hmm. For example, Imam Sajjad alayhi salatu wasalam, he was giving charity in that specific way.
Very true.
He was carrying a baggage, for example, and he was carrying to the poor people. Mm-hmm. But maybe in this time that we are living, you do not need to carry a baggage.
Very true.
I want to say that in this way. But the concept of giving charity
to
be helpful for the destitute and poor people.
It doesn't matter that you're living in a village or, let's say, a small city or a large city.
Exactly.
So the change of paradigm only here is that the only paradigm that is changing is that the, let's say, the environment changes.
Exactly. I want to say that we have some changes in the forms, mm-hmm. okay, which we call it mutaghayyirha, or some, changes in the form of practicing something. On the other hand, we have something which is unchangeable, mm-hmm. okay, which always remain forever.
Al-muhkamat.
or you can call it thawabit, or something unchangeable, or a strong thing which remains forever, everlasting concept. And these concepts are, you know, prevailing all over the time, in each place and in each time. You can have it and you can practice it.
Very true.
Okay?